Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. Whether you're tuning in live or listening to the podcast, please join me, Jeremy Mags, as I explore the issues and ideas shaping our world with key thinkers and decision makers. So let's get started, sharp, relevant, and straight to the heart of the story. Coming up on the program, does the Land Expropriation Act pose a serious threat to food security? Could smart technology help end South Africa's water crisis? A new year and new scams, and growing concern about a new state enterprise super company. It's Tuesday, the 28th of January. Now, with government pushing forward with the controversial expropriation bill, there are growing concerns over the future of land ownership, investment, and food security. And here's the question: could these policies threaten the stability of farming and agribusiness, or are they necessary steps towards meaningful land reform? I'm in conversation now with Johan Gortzer, who is the Chief Executive Officer at AgriSA. Johan, thank you very much indeed. So your organization has strongly opposed this bill. What are the biggest concerns that farmers and agribusiness have about the legislation?
Yeah, I think the term is we were highly concerned and disappointed in the outcome of what the bill kind of proposes. And maybe one or two concepts to this. I think the first thing is the uncertainty it brings into the South African community. So I think we could have dealt with it better in just addressing this uncertainty. And you know what normally happens with uncertainty, there's a lot of politics that's added to it, and all of a sudden you get a boiling pot, and it was not supposed to be. So that would be my first reaction. The second one is the uncertainty regarding the outcome of the interpretation of the law. And I think that wasn't tested. So if you ask me from a farmer's point of view, I think that's the greatest concern that we have, is we do not know. We do not know, and it's not the definition of what needs to be expropriated is not clearly set out. So I think there's a lot of comfort also that we can take out of what was proposed. But I think the most important thing is for us as farmers is the uncertainty that we need to deal with.
That is worrisome. How do you think that uncertainty could have been better dealt with?
It's a difficult one because you have a lot of emotions on both sides. It's not an easy way to find a midway. But I think with the government of national unity now, maybe they should have referred it back to the National Council and have a discussion again regarding what needs to happen. Or you push it back to the Constitutional Court and say, but listen, have a look at this. And I think that would have kind of cleared up a lot of uncertainties that we still need to deal with.
The government, Johan Gortzer, is insisting that fast passage of this legislation is necessary for land reform. Do you think then, again, coming at it from your perspective, is there a better way to achieve meaningful transformation while also protecting property rights?
Jeremy, I don't think we're against it. I think in our letter we also stated clearly that we are, as AgriSA and as farmers in South Africa, we understand the transformation drive and we understand what needs to happen. I think the only thing that comes to mind when we talk about where you protect private property rights, for us as a farming community, our finance and the way that we raise capital is based on property. So that is a major concern if that comes into dispute. Although the law does talk about protecting the farmers' rights or the private property rights, it still need to be contested in court and to understand the meaning thereof. So I don't think it's an issue for us as farmers that we oppose transformation and we oppose, I would say, the direction of what government is doing. We oppose to a certain extent the manner and the way they want to do it, because actually it's putting a lot of pressure on private property and the rights thereof.
You've also argued, if I read this correctly, that secure property rights are a key to food security. Could you just explain to me how potential land expropriation might disrupt food production and supply chains?
So as farmers, we go to a commercial bank and money is raised from a commercial bank and they are on lenders of money. The moment that you disrupt and bring uncertainty into a market, what do you do then? You just lift the risk. So for us as farmers, we're fighting a difficult year with late plantings and we don't know how the year's going to pan out. Some of the places are still dry. All of this are just adding up to a lot of uncertainty. And uncertainty in our market raises risk. And so if you have a look at food security, the moment we can't borrow money as working capital for the next input, for the next harvest that we need to what we foresee we're going to have, you kind of put pressure on food security in South Africa. And all we're saying is we need to be mindful in decision-making with the fact that we need to make sure that we secure food for the nation that we're part of. And I think that's the concept out of which we reason this.
So what is your next play as far as this is concerned?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to make sure that people don't grab this thing as a fear motive and drive fear. So we need to manage the emotions. And I think the first thing is to say it's a long-standing concept, this law. You know, it started 2016 already, and there was a lot of conversation in this. We are where we are today, where we need to go and test this law. But for us, the next is to go back and see senior counsel, which we've done before. And then what we need to do is be advised accordingly and not being driven by emotions as what we have now. So we need to be very wise in this situation that we don't add up to this uncertainty, but actually calm it down and play it into a field where we know what the way forward is. So for us, it's senior counsel to make sure we understand their way forward and the way they anticipate and see this playing out and then play accordingly.
You talk about managing emotions, but on the ground, farmers must be worried.
Yeah, we are. And I think we deal with so many uncertainties as farmers. This is just not just another one in. You know, many times the bucket overflows because of one drop. And that drop is not the reason why it's overflowing. It is because it's full of uncertainties. And I think the uncertainties is just it's just piling up. And I think this is another drop that we put into it. But Jeremy, I also need to say to you, we farmers, and we're going to overcome this. We've overcome so many things in the past, and I'm talking about droughts. I'm talking about floods of prices collapsing. So we need to manage this. And I think that's what we said to ourselves at board level at AgriSA is, it is what it is. What is the next steps? And the way we're going to react towards this, and out of our reaction is going to come an outcome, and that that's what we need to play with the stuff that we have in our hands and that we can work with to ensure that South Africa benefits out of this.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Johan Kotze, Chief Executive Officer, AgriSA.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's water crisis has become as critical as load shedding, with President Ramaphosa calling it an urgent priority for this year. Water shortages are not just an economic risk, but also a major threat to daily life. With aging infrastructure, rising demand, and climate pressure, the country faces increasing water insecurity. But here's the question: could smart technology be the missing link? Some experts believe digital tools, data analytics, and AI-driven monitoring could reduce wastage, improve efficiency, and optimize water management. I want to explore that in a little more detail today. Dr. Andrew Dixon is with us, engineering executive at CBI Electric Low Voltage. Andrew, a very warm welcome. Thank you very much for talking to me today. The president says water security is as critical as load shedding. In your opinion, how bad is the situation?
Jeremy, thank you for having me. In my opinion, it is a big worry. It is a very big concern. And unlike electricity, where we've kind of been able to weather the storm, water infrastructure and purification becomes a big, big problem. And particularly in the likes of places like Joburg and Gauteng, where we know we have no natural supply, we are highly dependent on infrastructure.
What, in your opinion, is the biggest driver behind this crisis?
I think time, people, and management. So all of those have contributed to increased requirements. And slowly, as the infrastructure has had to grow, as it's had to support more and more usage, that infrastructure maintenance hasn't necessarily been maintained. And so as a result, we land up increasing our losses over time. And those losses are, I'm afraid to say, at this point in time, out of control.
So there is a solution as far as you're concerned, and that's smart technology. What are we talking about, and how might it improve water security?
So for me, and if you look at what the experts are saying out there in the real world, our biggest problem is we don't actually know the real details. We don't have visibility. We know what, or we perceive an idea of where we're seeing the losses, how much we are actually losing, but actually no one really, really knows that number. And so smart technology enables two things. One is it provides us a means of getting information or data. And that data then becomes useful when we start to analyze it and use it in models to predict where, when, and how things might happen.
So practically, how might this work?
So let's start at the top. And what most people do is start with the basic monitoring. So this is monitoring on a municipal level, and it's monitoring at a consumer level. Because again, it's a system. We put water in at the top, we take water out at the bottom. Now, these two should match. And if they don't match, then we need to know where those discrepancies are. So smart metering is where we start. And that is the ability to pick up the high-level information and be able to disseminate that down. The next level then starts to look at leak detection, because obviously we all know we drive the city streets, we see water leaking out of everywhere. And that leak detection becomes obviously a very big revenue loss for a municipality. And therefore, we need to be able to create more water in order to be able to consume water lower down. And if we could proactively close off those leaks as they start, not months, days, years later, then we start to be able to rectify the system, which means we start to actually collect money for the water that we're moving through the system. And then we can stabilize the network.
I guess the question would be then, would solutions like this be, one, affordable, and secondly, scalable, particularly in some municipal areas which are vastly underfunded?
I don't think we have a funding choice. So by the mere losses of revenue that we simply cannot recoup because of leaks, that in itself would pay for its, you know, the cost of the infrastructure spend would probably be offset against the losses on the leaks just in the short term. And by doing that, obviously, then your revenue base becomes a more committed value, which means we then know how much we actually can spend on maintenance and infrastructure. There have been many test pilot cases around the world where, in fact, they've seen significant drop in maintenance costs. And here, primarily, we're talking man on the street, feet on the ground, doing maintenance work. If we can predict and ensure that those leaks are detected early, then those leaks don't become massive problems and therefore take more time, cost more money. So it's the ability to identify those early, which is what this technology will enable.
So, Andrew, if smart tech then is the answer and you make a very compelling case, I guess I've got to ask the question, what's stopping us from implementing it at scale, given the seriousness of the crisis?
I think it's exposure. Again, energy was the easy one. Energy is where everyone's been for a very long time. Water is still something that is relatively new. Though there are companies out there that have very good solutions, they do come at a cost. Not everyone knows how to implement it, and you need to be able to roll it out en masse. And as you said earlier, that is a high cost, but that input cost ultimately in the months to years post that will give you a good return on investment and allow us to ensure water security and safety. And that to me, I think, is something which is what Cyril Ramaphosa is focusing on and saying we cannot actually afford to go down that road, though I think we are a long way down that road. If we don't start now, we're going to be in serious, serious trouble.
Given that we've acknowledged over 300 days of no load shedding, the reality is we still do have an energy crisis in South Africa. Things are very fragile. So there is a causal link, surely, between the energy crisis and the water crisis. It would be difficult, surely, for the tech solutions that you're proposing to work under these risky conditions.
Yes and no. The tech obviously requires energy, because it runs off some sort of power source. However, if we can just start on the base levels where we've got sort of protection through infrastructure, buildings that are enclosed, etc., generally there is some sort of backup available, because obviously pump stations have to remain active in order to get water through the network. It is a problem. We need to identify those risks, understand how to mitigate those risks, but we need to be doing something. To wait and to see what might happen, again, as a city, as a whole, as people, we can manage without the electricity component in our lives, but we cannot manage without clean water in our lives. And that, I think, is the critical focus area.
Dr. Andrew Dixon, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
So as we step into 2025, scammers are becoming more sophisticated and they're targeting people when they are most vulnerable, whether they're looking for jobs, investing in their future, or simply trying to stick to their financial resolutions. From fake job offers to fraudulent investment schemes, the latest wave of scams is more deceptive than ever. So let's get into this now. Athalie Khan is with us, Head of Fraud Risk Management at Standard Bank. Athalie, a very warm welcome to you. So every year around about this time, we see a rise in scams. I'm wondering what makes the beginning of the year such a prime opportunity for fraudsters.
Fraudsters often exploit times of self-improvement, like New Year's resolutions. They target people who are motivated but slightly distracted. Consumers are obviously faced with heightened vulnerability as scammers exploit the changes they want to make in their lives at this particular time of the year.
So many people, as you rightly say, Athalie, are eager to grow their wealth in January, the beginning of the year. It's understandable that they are easy targets. So in that respect, then, what are the biggest red flags to watch out for, particularly when it comes to investment scams?
I think one of the biggest red flags that we look for, or that consumers should look for, is the promise of high returns with little effort. I think it's very uncanny that a huge company would ask you to put a small amount in and to receive such a high return on the investment. So unsolicited investment, they offer high returns with little or no risk. And this gives rise to scammers who prey on people, especially when they're looking at renewed financial resolutions.
But it's such a difficult one, isn't it? Because many people are so desperate at this time of the year and they would be seduced by something, even if it's too good to be true.
Most definitely. But what you have to look out for is when they create a sense of urgency. So this urgency is always, there's a period that this would only last for, and it's usually a short period, so they could get you to actually invest with them. So most companies would give you a reasonable amount of time to look at the investment, to understand it, etc. What the scammers would do is they create that urgency and let you know it's a once-off opportunity and you have to do it right now.
So investment is one aspect of this problem, but students and parents at this time of the year are also under pressure to secure funding for education. So do you have a sense of the tactics that scammers are now using in that respect, and maybe what people should do to verify legitimate student loan offers?
Definitely. Scammers pose as a financial institution or a financial service provider, where they offer reduced rates for students and for student loans. Victims are asked to pay upfront fees and share sensitive information, which most institutions, especially financial institutions, would not do. These schemes are often tied to legitimate educational institutions, which makes them harder to detect. So research in this regard is extremely important.
So if it's not investment or education, it's also about health and fitness, isn't it?
Most definitely. And they're generally endorsed by people that people look up to. They look at celebrities, etc. And they use fake celebrity endorsements and fabricated testimonials, which often require upfront payments as well. They often too good to be true. There's no celebrity who would actually put their name behind these type of products.
So you mentioned a little earlier, Athalie, that scammers are masters of manipulation, and you talked about them creating an urgency to pressure victims into making mistakes. How does that urgency manifest itself?
they would give you a timeline, or they would say that this is a once-off offer and it's never to be seen again. And that timeline is usually a short period so that they can create urgency and confusion. Because what customers or consumers would generally do is look for a solution and a quick solution. And if they miss it, then, you know, they believe that they would not be able to get that type of deal again, a once-in-a-lifetime kind of guarantee.
So as far as the financial services sector is concerned, and your bank included, do you think that you're on top of all of this?
I think it's important to note that we try and educate our customers as much as we can. We try to send them information. We also have a security link on our app, which will advise you of all of the different types of scams out there and what to do and what not to do. We have many, many digital and online safety tips, as well as financial awareness. And one of the most important things is always make sure that you're notified or you have your notifications on so that you're always aware of what's happening in your bank, through your banking accounts, etc.
The problem with that, of course, is that not everyone engages with the kind of warnings that you and other institutions are putting out. They simply ignore them.
Generally, we have a good take-up where customers actually read and ask questions, especially on our social media platforms. We do, however, have customers who kind of flip through these things, which is so important. It's so important for us to read the information that is shared through our financial institutions, as the fraudsters are gaining so much momentum out there, and they are targeting so many people who are, one, vulnerable, and who are susceptible to scams.
You talk about fraudsters gaining momentum. Do you think it's becoming more difficult for financial institutions to stay ahead of the curve then?
I think it's not only difficult. I think because of the AI, because of the new technology, etc., there's so many different types of scams out there, and it's very difficult for consumers to actually know what is true, what is real and not real. That is why, as an institution, especially from our perspective, we try and put out as many functionality, one on our app, our online presence, to make sure that our customers are informed. It's so important to send out information and for customers to be informed.
And just a final question, what is your view about current legislation, and do you think it's strong enough to tackle financial fraud? Does more need to be done at policy level?
I think from a policy perspective, we all work very closely, you know, with the different policy holders and creators within the industry. There's so much momentum and so much conversations happening, and many, many, many sessions where we talk about and engage with each other. Because of the different types of fraud scams that we see emerging, this has become very important for the industry as a whole to tap into this. And we have very rigorous conversations trying to support and help our consumers. There's always more that we can do. There's always more that we try to invest in. And I think one of the important things is that our clients and our consumers, we always put them first. And from a policy perspective, we are really working on the best solutions for our, not only for the banks, but for the country.
Athalie Khan, thank you very much indeed. Head of Fraud Risk Management at Standard Bank.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you might be aware that a new state-owned super company is on the horizon, and it could change the face of South Africa's economy. The National State Enterprises Bill, if passed, would place the likes of Eskom, Transnet, SAA and other key entities under one government-controlled holding company. And critics are warning this is potentially state capture 2.0, a dangerous move, they say, that could deepen political interference, weaken accountability and expose public assets to unchecked government control. Now, Free SA, a civil rights organization, is calling on South Africans to speak out against the bill during a public participation process. I'm joined from the organization by Nolutando Hlopoi. Nolutando, welcome and thank you very much for joining us. Let's start with the big picture, if we can. Why does Free South Africa believe this bill is a major threat to the economy? Where are your concerns?
So our concerns, actually, they're basically in the part where
It reduces this bill reduces, of course, accountability when it comes to our SEO, to our SOEs, actually. So they'll be operating outside the Public Finance Management Act, which oversees them currently, and it will also weaken the parliamentary control. So there'll be less direct accountability to Parliament, and also part of it also is the property rights issue. So some could control the land transfer and property between the SOEs and the public scrutiny. So also the financial impact of this, because it's estimated that for the state asset management to run, we will need about 50 million in per year. So that means that more money from taxpayer. So those are the major concerns that we are highlighting on this bill.
In fact, you've gone on to say, the organization has gone on to say, that this is State Capture 2.0. Are there specific elements of the bill that would make it vulnerable to corruption and political interference?
As we know, currently, this bill, of course, it also, as I've mentioned, it removes, there's an element of it where it removes the accountability and transparency. So that is why we are saying it is State Capture 2.0. Because as I've just also mentioned right now, it weakened, of course, the parliamentary control. So there'll be a less direct accountability to Parliament. So meaning that the public might not actually be fully aware of the operation and the runnings, particularly in terms of finances, operation of this of SEMCO.
You'll be aware that supporters of the bill say that centralizing SOEs will improve efficiency and coordination. The government going on to say that the bill is necessary for reforming state-owned enterprises. How do you respond to that counter-argument?
Currently, we know the question is this. What has stopped our government in making sure that the SOEs are run efficiently? So would you then trust that with this formulation of the state asset management, will it really improve the progress of our SOEs? So we believe as an organization that not at all. If there were such, then why should we create a mother company that actually would mean, or rather that will be in the, to a sense that will hide the operations of the SOEs? How will that be progress? The efficiency, it does not necessarily make sense at this point.
As I say, government is claiming that reform of SOEs is critical. I think that is common cause. So has your organization applied its mind to an alternative solution as far as reform is concerned?
Not in particularly, but right now we believe that, for instance, there are a progress that is going on. For if we were to mention the Eskom part, in terms of this, of course, we haven't experienced load shedding. So we have seen that having the right people, hiring the right people in this organization, it does actually help in terms of combating the current issues that we are faced with. Of course, Eskom is not necessarily profitable at this point, but we believe that at the right time, the Eskom might get to a point of being profitable. So the reformation, yes, it might be great, but I'd say that it actually needs to include the right people in the organization that can actually improve the current state of this of the SEO, instead of actually just formulating a mother company that might not necessarily, that will actually cost us more as taxpayers.
In other words, what you're saying, it should be a bottom-up build rather.
Yes.
These organizations, yes, need to get things right within their own house first, and that will,
exactly,
go a long way towards more effective reform.
Exactly.
So you're calling on South Africans to voice their concerns about this. What do you want the public to do? And do you think that government actually listens to public participation? Is this effective in any way in terms of shaping legislation, do you think?
It is. However, I do know as well that currently our government is trying by all means to overlook the public participation as means to sort of to make us less motivated in doing this, of which it's quite important. If it was not actually effective, if you think about it, what will happen one day when we're unable to vote? So these platforms are quite important so that we can continue to have our say. A government that is currently running the country wouldn't want us to have our voice heard
but I'd say that as a citizen who's paying tax money, it's important for us to have our voices said. So we are urging the public to please go to our website to have their voice on this campaign currently, which is quite important. So I wouldn't want South Africans to lose hope when it comes to of our say. It's quite important.
Just a final one and a quick one. Do you have a sense of timelines here? We talk about the super company being on the horizon, but what's the sense of when?
So time-wise, it's not actually quite clear. As we know that, of course, the bill is not yet signed in. So as an organization, we will continue to keep the public communicating to the public, so to keep them away of the timelines when it comes to this.
Thank you very much for joining me today from Free SA, Nolutando Hlophoi. Thank you very much indeed. And that's our program for today. We are back tomorrow with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.